101, a version 1 podcast.
Welcome to the 101 podcast, conversations about technology and innovation with some of the UK and Ireland's leaders and trailblazers. My name's Peter Gothard, and today I'm joined by Charles Ewan, Director of Technology and Chief Information Officer at the Met Office. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Thank you, and good morning.
So, I guess while people are familiar with the Met Office and what it does, i.e. it produces the daily weather forecast, I wonder if maybe, Charles, you could give us a bit more of a flavour as to what happens at the Met Office, maybe on, you know, with a technological basis.
Sure. So technology, the relationship between what the Met Office does and technology has always been a close one. So structured approaches to organization that deliver weather prediction goes back to the late 1800s. And the Met Office is a part of UK government. So it's the agency accountable for weather and climate, which is quite unusual. I might come back to that for the UK. But it's a part of government in something that's known as a trading fund, which is a bit odd. So I'll spend a little bit of time explaining what that is. So a trading fund is an organization that is a part of government. So I'm a civil servant, as is everybody that works at the Met Office. However, we are also obliged to interact with commercial markets. And the reason for that, obviously, is a good knowledge of the future state of the atmosphere, both in the long and short term, has huge relevance for decision making. And so in order that the Met Office, the taxpayer, realizes the most benefit from the Met Office, it's important that where necessary, we can interact with things that are contracted so that we're providing the very best advice to enable decision making. So that's kind of structurally, if you like, where we are. The Met Office is one of 191 agencies that are grouped together under the auspice of something called the World Meteorological Organization. And then again, that's technical, that lays down the guardrails of interoperability. So as you can imagine, weather, maybe less intuitively, but certainly climate very intuitively, is a very global business. So there's a need for the free exchange of data to make sure that systems are compatible, data sets are understood, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really what the WMO do, the World Meteorological Organization. And then finally, the Met Office is a world-renowned research institute, both in terms of weather science and climate science. We author, do a lot of research, undertake a lot of research with many, many partners, both in the UK and around the world, and we publish a lot of papers. So if you like, you can think of the Met Office in those chunks, and they don't always line up neatly from a requirements point of view, and that applies to technology. So just dipping back into the history a little bit, one of the computers that was first recognised is as probably the first Turing, full Turing compatible computer, was something called the ENIAC, back in the 40s, and that machine was delivered against its ability to serve three use cases. One of them was about ballistics, one of them was about physics, and the other one was about weather. And so we've kind of been in it from the start in terms of how large scale computation is used for weather forecasting. And to some extent, the world of supercomputers, which I'll talk a little bit about later, and the world of agencies like the Met Office have kind of grown up hand in hand. To some extent, we've influenced how that technology has grown. And to some extent, it's kind of shaped and put constraints in the way that we do our job. So at one level, one big important area of technology is the supercomputer. We'll come back to say what that does and why it does it. But of course, what comes out of a supercomputer is scientific data. So it's full of latent information, latent useful stuff. But actually, you probably need a very big compute environment yourself and a PhD in physics or mathematics to do very much with the output of the supercomputer. So we're a very customer-driven organization, as good ones tend to be. And so to that end, there's quite a long chain of technology that goes towards something that would recognizably be what in most people's experience would look like a weather forecast. When you get into the kind of professional user extent, you can imagine there are things like tactical decision aids that assist people like fast jet pilots to decide where they fly, how they fly, whether they can be seen, safe to land, and so on and so forth. They look less like weather forecasts, but are very much still driven by the weather. And an easy way to think about that is in three chunks. So if you think about the kinds of technology that supports science, research science, a growing mankind's understanding of weather and climate systems, supercomputing, very large scale storage is one kind of loose area. Another area others will be very familiar with, they're the kinds of last mile technologies that serve customers. So this is apps and APIs, rich internet applications, websites, and so on and so forth. And then at the Met Office, we've got a very substantial chunk in the middle. Apologies for the lack of sophistication in that, but I think about it in terms of enterprise technology. And the role of that technology is essentially to turn that very difficult to deal with, but full of latent information, scientific data, into data sets that are much better able to support decision making and feed the last mile kind of technologies towards customers. And that's a very significant area. So at the very highest level, three kind of chunks of technology. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense. Thank you. There's also an awful lot to unpack there. You're clearly very, very busy and doing an awful lot with technology there. I didn't know that about ENIAC for a start. That's a very, very interesting point to begin with, that weather was essentially at the basis of one of the first Turing computers. And as you say, you've been leading that charge ever since. So a lot of the things you've described, data, essentially data technology and technology that deals with reams and reams of data. You've been doing that obviously a lot longer than other people have, but I guess now also next to your supercomputers, you're going to be thinking about moving to the cloud. In fact, I know you are because we've been talking about that a little bit before we began here. I suppose what I'm wondering is how you're sort of managing that new kind of combination of technologies that are taking, large supercomputers and moving into something more cloud-based.
That's great. So that's a good question, of course. So we've been active in the cloud for a very long time, quite an early adopter 6 years ago at scale, probably something like that, 7 years ago, in public cloud technologies for the delivery of these last mile technologies that I've mentioned. So yes, we use all the major cloud providers. We tend to do more work with AWS right now than anybody else, but that's not a strategic choice, much more than a practical choice. Right. Things like training and familiarity with the specific technologies. As you'll know, not all cloud providers are the same come to bear. So we do a lot of work in AWS. They're a key partner for us, and we're quite experienced in working with that model. And that's certainly been started off with that third last mile kind of technology, and it certainly does more and more aspects of that center chunk of enterprise technologies, as I referred to it, or turning the really difficult scientific data into useful data sets that are context aware and ready to answer specific questions. To answer your question, the first section, public cloud providers and others, there are very valid high performance computing systems that are available in many, many applications, run very well in large instances on public cloud and indeed other flavors of cloud computing. There's a wrinkle for the Met Office, and it's a wrinkle that is to some extent comes up by the intrinsic mathematics of what we do, and I won't spend too long on that because if you don't have to do your math, that can get very boring very quickly, but I can talk a little bit about that. And secondly, the thing that I mentioned, whereby to some extent our workload and supercomputing in a traditional sense have kind of grown up together. And so like any kind of productive symbiotic relationship, you kind of rely on one another. And to some extent, the way HPC is delivered on the cloud is fundamentally quite a different approach to the way that traditional supercomputing has been delivered. So let me just dip into that difference and try and steer away from as much maths as I can. Okay. Now, a way to think about it, which is reasonably close to the fact, is that if you think about the way that honeybees scale, any honeybee will leave the hive and pretty much do the same job as every other honeybee. And the more honeybees you've got, the more active that hive will be and the more honey that you'll produce. But what you've got are little machines that are going out there all doing exactly the same task, but doing that at massive, wide scale. Conversely, if you think about some worker ants, some army ants, trying to lift a stick that no one of those ants could could individually lift on its own, then that requires all of them are doing slightly different tasks to the same outcome. But again, it's at scale. So you can think about that as a orchestrated serial compute as opposed to a orchestrated parallel compute. So the mathematics to a large extent dictate that that calculating the future state of the environment is a serial task. It's something that you need to perform mathematical calculations, and you can only proceed to the next step when you've understood the result of the last step that was undertaken. Whereas typically the way that cloud compute is optimized for are for being able to break a job down into many like similar jobs or yes. same jobs and be able to execute those at massive parallelism. So, and that relates to things like graph-based data approaches, whereby the whole point of a graph database is it allows massively serial access, and you can change the nodes and relationships within that graph very easily all at the same time, as opposed to a kind of more traditional, for those of you that are old enough, kind of locking records and only able to access one record at one time. Does that give you a sense, at least, of the kind of fundamental challenge?
It does, absolutely. And I love the analogy about lifting the stick. So without getting too deep and maybe getting too entrenched in the maths, could you explain a little bit more about how those technologies, you know, are comparing or working together?
Yeah, sure. So a way to think about it is I want you to picture a fish tank of water. And in that fish tank of water, you take a drop of ink and you drop that ink into the fish tank. And just through common experience, you'll realize that ink will mix into the water in a swirly kind of way. That's known as advection scientifically. And I'll use advection and calculating advection as the example. The way that we would approach that problem computationally is to put a virtual set, three-dimensional grid inside that fish tank, and we would use a technique called successive approximation to at each node of where that mesh interacts, we would do some partial differential equations, and we'd solve those. The issue, of course, is that you can't just keep doing that, because you can imagine just intuitively that those eventually those approximations, because that's all they are, would not represent the global picture. So what we also need to do is to let those calculations to take place, and then to periodically, quite frequently, ensure that the adjacent calculations are aware of the answers of the preceding calculations from adjacent nodes. Does that make sense? So that you can maintain this global swirling effect that you can imagine the ink will take place in the fish tank. And to do that, to put it into slightly more technical terms, we rely very heavily on I/O. So people think a supercomputer is all about sheer computational capacity and capability, and that's absolutely true. But it's increasingly, as CPU-based supercomputers have evolved, become a factor of I/O, if you like, or the degree to which those calculations can reinform each other of their current state. And so in a supercomputer, you typically get a node-to-node latency performance of something less than a microsecond, whereas if you look at a typical public cloud-based environment, it would be at least an order of magnitude lower than that. So you can run a weather model, and many have done so, on a public cloud environment in its current form. However, it's not efficient, effective, and therefore economically sensible to do so. You still get much more bang for buck running on a traditional supercomputer. So that's the challenge at hand. So where we are is we are very much working with both traditional supercomputer companies and public cloud companies, and also have a shadow five-year program, which whose internal name is something called ELFRIC. That relates to Louis Fry Richardson, who was one of these people back in the ENIAC days that devised a computational approach to weather forecasting. That program is looking at how we can restructure our codes to reduce the need and dependency on a traditional supercomputer architecture to the best degree possible. Another way to think about it is the ability to better exploit heterogeneous architectures. And that's more formally, that's what we say. We say what we want to be able to do is to break our maths down and run the relevant maths in the most appropriate environment, instead of running it all in a traditional CPU model. And that's very much the work that's underway right now and will come into play for our next generation of supercomputing.
Wow. So, okay, everything's complementing everything else really well. It seems like you found your level and have had that level for quite a few years as well. I suppose what's interesting me from hearing all of this, and it's fascinating, you've got all this technology flying about and all of these, you know, great toys to play with. When it comes to, you know, leading business change, I wonder if there's a temptation for the technology to do that because everybody's very excited. So how do you, you know, as the CIO, kind of keep things, you know, real and keep things business and customer focused?
That's a great question. And tempting though it is that the geeks rule the earth, and being a thoroughbred geek, I'm obviously that's appealing. That's not, in my opinion anyway, isn't a great, isn't a utopian future anyway. The organization really think about this in terms of people, process, and technology, being aware of each other's constraints and setting guardrails for one another. So we try to work really hard and do that in a very structured way to ensure that the way the technology is shaped, as you can see, definitely brings constraints into the way that people work and they undertake their day-to-day work. However, it shouldn't necessarily dictate and define it. Equally, the way that we want to work as an organization from the people front sets its own constraints, and we need to be aware of those. And the processes themselves that we invent to allow those people to interact with the technology also sets some constraints. So we use that word an awful lot, and we use the word positively as opposed to negatively. And you can think about it in terms of guardrails. So that ends up in policies that are like guardrails. They give people an awful lot of autonomy to make free autonomous decisions. We've done lots of work on teams and how you have happy and productive ones. And we've looked at others, some of the public cloud vendors and the big tech companies. And some of them talk about it in terms of mastery, autonomy, and purpose as the three things that people turn up to work to achieve. So mastery, as you can probably imagine, is one we can put a big tick against. At the Met Office, we're privileged to be able to work with some of the very cutting edges of technology, which is fantastic, and we've got some world-leading experts in what we do. Purpose is also very high on the list and gets a big tick because the Met Office is, at the end of the day, trying to help people make better decisions to stay safe and thrive, and that's a very lofty reason to work for an organization, so that's good. Autonomy can be the one that, if we're not very, very careful and very thoughtful about how we set the guardrails or the constraints, apply those constraints, can be difficult. Put yourself in the shoes of a world-leading scientist that's never worked at the Met Office, a physicist that's been working in some other area, some fluid dynamics grand challenge, coming to work for the Met Office. Inevitably, the way that we do our technology will set some constraints on their freedom and autonomy to do their very best and bring their best to work and produce their best outcomes because of the way that we do things. What we try and do is not be shy about the fact that those things exist. They absolutely do. But try and make those guardrails as holistically productive as they possibly can be. So in short, it's really about getting the mix of the guardrails around people, process, and technology. A, make sure you know what they are, and B, make sure how they interact with one another.
Right. So, I mean, that's important. If I was playing devil's advocate, you know, I could maybe say, well, this still sounds like a more trendy way of siloing people. But I suppose, as you say, if you focus on the interaction, I'd love to know how you're doing that, really. And also, is that technology enabled, or is that more about culture, or is it both?
Yeah, all of those words are relevant. And what we try and do is how does it really look? It really ends up as policy. So we spend a lot of time on policy, and we use policy to inform sort of training and instruction and those kinds of things. And those policies really are the things that say, and we use Moscow quite a lot, must do, should do, could do, so that people are really clear about where, if their view for as a person working within a process trying to deliver outcome is that, well, we know we should do this, but actually it's only a should do. And our autonomous decision is such that I can justify to anybody that might ask, I haven't done what I should do simply because I've got a reason not to, and here's what my reason is. If it's a must-do statement, then you'd expect them to be coming back and saying, well, I'd love to do what your policy tells me to do. However, it's going to place this impossible constraint on me delivering the outcome that I need to deliver. So there's tension there. I won't pretend there isn't. There absolutely is tension there, and all of our policies are terribly popular. However, they are real-world, written-down guardrails that hopefully give people as much autonomy and as much scope as they possibly can to make good decisions at a local level.
Cool. So yeah, essentially you're giving people sandboxes that they can play within with total freedom, unless they hit. It's almost, I guess it's almost like programming. You've got these statements that they run into, and it's like, you know, yeah, you must do this or you could do this, and then it's almost go to next step.
That's exactly right, and that's where we've taken, you know, my previous comment of maybe I do want geeks to rule the world. We've definitely taken that kind of way that you would write a programming specification in terms of musts and coulds and shoulds, and we've applied that to the way that we think about and deliver policy. That's absolutely spot on.
Brilliant. That sounds really, really progressive. We've talked a bit about, you know, giving people space to work. And you know, the guardrails, but in terms of this sort of process piece that you mentioned earlier, how does the actual process play out on a daily basis?
So we've got a lot of work to do in that area. And if I had to talk about the area that is most efficient, it's probably process. So a bit of history again, the Met Office, as I've said, go way, way back to the dawn of Turing complete computing in the way that it's interacted with technology. And therefore, we do to some extent have a heritage, I won't use the word legacy, I'll use the word heritage, of fantastic innovation through technology, but stacked generation upon generation upon generation. So we do have a bit of a legacy issue, especially in that kind of center piece of the kind of technology that takes what comes out of the supercomputer and turns it into useful things that can be used in last mile technologies, applications, customers, and so on. So in there, process plays a big part. And some of those, it's probably the area where we're most prescriptive, is trying to build a common, and you know, we'll all be aware now of event-triggered architectures, headless architectures, platform thinking. Those are all the right words to define what we're trying to do in that middle section. So in that middle section, what does it look like from a process point of view? Well, firstly, thinking about how the people are arranged and how the people interact with the process, we are very keen on multidisciplinary teams. So there's a few things that we've, through experience, really very much bought into because we've got evidence that they work. So things like diverse teams, you do not get the best outcome from having, you know, 7 or 8 clones, even if they have got PhDs in math and physics, working on the same problem through the same lens. That typically doesn't give you the best outcome unless it happens to be a physics problem, of course. So in the real world of delivering value, we use multidisciplinary teams very extensively. And a multidisciplinary team will have obviously a big chunk of development capability in there, but it'll also have things like somebody who's definitely done some work with MSP, know how to interact with processes, know the value and importance of clean artifacts at the various points of the process. We work in the Agile in the Spotify scalability model for Agile. So that comes with some ways of working, retrospectives and stand-ups and so on and so forth. And the teams themselves will for development work, a lot of them will be developers, but you may well have designers in there. You'll certainly have applied architects in there. You'll certainly have security people in there. You will certainly have a customer representative of some sort in there. Depends how far down in the stack they're working as to how customer aware those people actually are. And that's the shape of the people that will interact with the processes. But the processes themselves are probably the area that's most prescriptive. So lots of autonomy at the individual working level decision area, quite a lot of diversity of thinking in the unit of measure of a team. Those teams, or squads as we call them, those squads will work within quite tightly defined boundaries in terms of how they define milestones. So they can be freewheeling and agile within those milestones, but we do need to know in some kind of good, fast and cheap i.e. what's the outcome going to look like, how much is it going to cost in terms of resource, what needs is it going to serve, what's your burn down look like. Those kinds of things are pretty prescriptive. So and most of the work that we've got ahead of us over the next few years is probably in that area and making it better.
Okay. That's really interesting. And again, I think it's doubling down on some of the earlier messages about freedom, you know, in this case, freedom in diversity, perhaps, but still giving people the guardrails to move along and within. I guess one thing I'm finding interesting to ask, in terms of recruiting people to be on these diverse teams, I mean, obviously the Met Office is going to be a place a lot of people are going to want to come and work probably, but are you finding it fairly straightforward or challenging to kind of put together these diverse dream teams?
I've got to be clear that at this moment I'm going to give some personal views, not necessarily those views that are formal Met Office policy and so on. So just make that point in case any of my colleagues might listen to this. It's always been my personal view that the way to employ the way to end up with high performing teams doing great things are to really go for the person first. And what I mean by that is, of course, where you went to university, what degree you achieved, those kinds of attainment-based things are important. But it's always been my personal view that actually you've got to see that person as being productive. They've got to be a Met Office person, if you like. They've got to recognise the purpose of what we're doing. They've got to buy into that purpose. They've really got to be there to make a difference. I use that phrase an awful lot with my teams. You know, let's make a difference, because we're privileged to be publicly funded, and it's our obligation to make as big a difference for the UK and humanity as we possibly can. And so it's those kinds of factors. Now, where is the Met Office on that journey to that people first approach to recruitment? I'm pleased to say some way. I've been at the Met Office now for a decade. Back in the day, it was very much we employ people based on those first sets of things. So what's your CV look like? How many papers have you published? Where's your absolute relevant experience that almost guarantees that the thing I'm going to ask you to do, you've already done? those kinds of measures. Whereas increasingly, we'll get people in. We use assessment centres a lot. And we'll give people some tasks to undertake, and we're not just looking at the outcome that they achieve, but the way they arrived about that outcome. And I'm not going to trivialize the importance of that, talking about behaviors and values based recruitment, because I think it's a bit more than what that says. Where we've had real notable successes with our kind of undergraduates and apprentices, so people more laterally into the organization, I'm not going to say we've taken punts, because I don't believe we have taken punts, but in certain areas we've taken people in that might have some work to do on their professional development side. They might not have the years of experience that we would traditionally have looked for, but we're very confident they're bright. By bright, I mean shiny. That's not an elitist intellectual comment, but they're shiny people. They're enthusiastic. They're committed to wanting to learn, and subsequently, some of them have gone off and done masters, or they've done degree apprenticeships, or whatever it might be, and they've achieved those professional skills that we needed them to. And those we've been doing this for. It's a bit insidious. It's taken, you know, it's been a switch over time, but certainly over the last 5 or 6 years, we've been very strong on this. And some of these people are absolutely thriving and showing the rest of us, frankly, those of us that are perhaps more traditional in the way we've got to the place that we are, what good looks like, if I'm being honest. So, really pleased with both the directionality and momentum that we've got in the way that we approach recruitment.
Okay, I think we're running a little low on time now, but I think, Charles, just to maybe try to wrap everything up and summarize, if you could give sort of one top tip or several small top tips to a CIO or a CTO who are trying to lead a change program, what would you advise them to do?
Okay, so I think point number one would be recognize the dynamics of technology change. And that comes down to trying to understand exponential functions. Technology grows exponentially, and that's been proven in many different ways, including but not exclusively Moore's law. So what that really means is, as if you think of technology in an information technology sense, something that really was born in the maybe 40s, 50s, 60s perhaps, then we've been doubling every period for some considerable time. And what that means is that you continue to double ever bigger numbers. So the, if you like, the delta or the change that happens, it's not so much that change is accelerating, it's the same function that's been there for a long time, but we're doubling big numbers. So the magnitude of the change that comes from technology is ever bigger. And that's just the thing. You can't fight that. And the need to think that the world will change from a technology point of view, and what was wrong a couple of years ago, what was right a couple of years ago might look very wrong a couple of years down the road, isn't something to lament, isn't something to beat yourself up about, isn't something to get sacked for from your board, but is a thing to build into your thinking. I could express that many different ways and talk about openness. Organizations, on the other hand, there's a law, Markov's law, I think, but I might have got that wrong, Markov's law, something like that, that demonstrates that organization can only change logarithmically, which is a much lower rate of change, and develops an ever-widening gap between those companies that can fully exploit technology and the company's ability to change. So we're all aware of the big tech giants. They're brilliant at technology. They're relatively new companies. Their time will come, just like every other organization, where they struggle to continue to change and adapt themselves the way they think, what their key strategies, priorities, investments are with the rate of change of technology. It's just that they're new. And traditional companies are well aware of that. So I think certainly one thing is rethink your expectations and your openness to new ideas, new developments, new technology innovations, and don't beat yourself up at the fact that your 2-year plan becomes very dated very quickly.
That sounds really, really good advice. Just avoid getting entrenched, I guess, in any kind of thinking that's just process in and of itself, as opposed to, I guess, keep an eye on the goal, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Keep an eye on the outcome. Yeah. It's all about the outcome. And I think it's all too easy as a technologist to become embroiled in the details of the delivery of that outcome and the particular stack or the particular flavor of technology. And increasingly, there are no right and wrong answers. Context of any given organization is absolutely everything. So the absolutely right place, and I know it's a well-trodden kind of metaphor, but you know, it's a journey, and all organizations and all people are at a different point of that journey. So I do get frustrated with articles or analysis that says, here's the right answer, ubiquitously. Because that can't possibly be true. What's right in one organization will simply not be right in another organization for all manner of complex reasons, including the culture and what's already in the shed and skills and competencies of teams and so on and so forth. So I'm much more humble than I used to be. I think 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I genuinely thought there was a right answer. And I spent a bit of time going from company to company, applying that right answer. And I think as I've certainly at the Met Office had to come to learn is there isn't one right answer. So that's not to say that the analyst companies and the research and the articles aren't good things, but I do read them always bearing in mind, well, I can see how this worked in that given case study organization, but equally I can identify why certainly facets of it might not work in mine. And that's not a reason to be different and unique. I'm not suggesting that at all. This huge wisdom of the crowd. However, in your own, any given CIO in any given organization, the particular recipe and style of cooking will be very different to get the same cake at the other end, i.e. the outcome. But thinking outcome first is probably my second tip, and that's probably more wisdom than any one person can have. I'm not sure it applies at all. But anyway, that's what's in my head.
Lovely. Thank you. Well, we'll leave it on that wonderful baking metaphor. You've been listening to the 101 podcast. I've been Peter Gothard, and I've been talking to Charles Ewan, Director of Technology and Chief Information Officer at the Met Office. Thank you for joining us today, Charles.
Thank you.
To find more editions of the 101 podcast, please do visit www.version1.com. Thank you very much for listening today. All the best and goodbye for now.
Thank you for listening to the 101 podcast. If you would like more information about any of our podcasts or our guests, visit us at version1.com/1-0-1.